For the most part, when I listen to people and they want to know about Christianity, they have questions like, well, how do I enter and what must I do? And I remember one long-term member of the church, he's no longer with us, but they just sort of asked me, what's the bottom line? How good do I really need to be? You know, what percentage of my money do I really need to give? And if you would just sort of nail it down, these are the commands, this is the money, this is the stuff, what do I do to make the cut? And last week we had this glimpse at Romans 8, which I continue to be on in the adult Sunday school class, where there's this amazing vision of all creation restored and renewed. And we very much sense that's not the way the world is right now. So I decided to ask, so there's these new AI engines out there on the internet. And so I decided to ask Bing Chat, which is sort of open GPT. It sort of scrapes the internet, actually. So I asked it the question, what does the Bible say I must do to be saved? I asked the internet. And this is the answer it gave me. According to the Bible, to be saved, we must believe in Jesus Christ as Lord, that God raised him from the dead. We must also repent of our sins and ask for God's forgiveness. Salvation is a gift of God's grace that we receive by faith, not by works. We can confess with our mouth and believe in our hearts that we are saved. I hope this helps, so the computer says. And I phrased it in such a way, and I played with the computer a little bit to try and give it answers that I knew would sort of be from other traditions. This is a very good Protestant answer with sort of forefronts belief. But the truth is, our lives are mixed, are partially made of beliefs, but also behaviors and attitudes and emotions. Most people get kicked out of church for behavioral issues. And most cheap people are not let in to become official members for confessional issues. How do their beliefs stack up with the other different churches? But a lot of people just want to know, well, will this work for me? And I'll ask them to tell me, okay, define work. And they have a sense of, well, I want good things to happen in my life. I want to be healthy. I want to have enough money. I want my relationships to go well. All of these things, and that's sort of like working, but at the same time they recognize, well, the world is big, and it's complicated, and trials come. Paul, in Romans 7, which was the chapter before we talked about last week, had this very famous passage. So I find this law at work. Although I want to do good, evil is right there with me. For in my inner being, I delight in God's law, but I see another law at work in me, waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner of the law of sin at work within me. What a wretched man I am. Who will rescue me from this body that is subject to death? Thanks be to God who delivers me through Jesus Christ our Lord. Paul says, not only is the problem out there in the world that the world doesn't give me what I want, if I look closer to home, I discover I can't even do the good that I know and decide I want to do. So how does all of this work? Am I really in? Am I doing it right? I'm not necessarily getting the results that I thought I should get. Now, during part of the year, we're in a thing called electionary, where we run through the seasons of the church, and we're entering the part of the year where we don't have electionary. And over the last number of years, I've been sort of walking through the entire Bible, and we're sort of been focused on Paul for the last little while. And if you go all the way back to November, you'll see we got all the way up to 1 Corinthians 10. And Corinth is really sort of an ideal example of these struggles, because the church at Corinth, well, Corinth was a vitally important city in sort of the middle of the Mediterranean, and there was a little isthmus. It was sort of like the Panama Canal, where that you could bring things through Corinth. And even though the Romans destroyed it about 200 years before the birth of Christ, the Romans eventually rebuilt it because it was such a strategic location. And the city there flourished by all of the traffic that went through Corinth. It was like a hub for the entire empire. And the church that started in Corinth thought it was the best church. They had the most money. They had the most spiritual gifts. And because of where they were, anybody sort of making their way between the vast Eastern Empire and Rome, the great city, would pass through Corinth. And so Peter passed through Corinth, and they got to listen to the Apostle Peter preach. And Paul had been through Corinth. And Apollos had been through Corinth. And anybody who was anyone in the Christian world had been through Corinth, and they had heard them all. And they were wealthier than most of the churches. And they were larger than most of the churches. And they had the higher status people. And so they thought, of all the churches in the Roman world, we must be the best. The relationship with Paul, however, was not good. Because Paul looked at them and thought, you're full of yourself, but you have no idea about what the gospel is and how it changes us. Paul thought they were something of a disaster of a church. And in this first letter to the Corinthians, Paul has a laundry list of issues. He had received a note from some people in the church that was reporting on some of the things happening. So he had a laundry list of things that were going on. And when we look at that list, we think, you thought you were a really good church? Well, first of all, your church is riddled with infighting. You have all of these factions that are perpetually warring with one another. You've got a guy in this church who is now sleeping with his mother or his stepmother, and you're bragging about it. The details of that are quite lost to us, but Paul says this kind of behavior would even shock the pagans. The fighting in your church is so bad, you're taking each other to civil court. Things that within the church you should probably be able to sort out. Men in your church are basically seeking out their sexual satisfaction through prostitutes. And you think, so what? Sex is sex. No, that's not how Christian men should behave. You have lots of questions. Should Christians marry at all? Is sexual abstinence of higher spiritual value than having a sex life? Should married Christians have sex? Should Christians seek circumcision? It's a big issue between the Jews and the Gentiles. Should Christian slaves seek emancipation? Should unmarried Christians seek marriage? What about food sacrificed to idols? Now, on this list, most of us would say, oh yeah, lots of questions about sex. Lots of questions about money and power. Food sacrificed to idols? I don't understand the big deal. Well, it's a very big deal because the city was full of these temples. And if anybody, I spoke a few weeks ago how religion in the ancient world, and I think this is actually continues to be the best definition of religion today, is the basic operating system of how to get ahead in life. And so if you really wanted to be successful in your business or successful in your marriage or successful in politics, you better find the right god or gods and make a lot of sacrifices in their temple. And what that meant was you had all of these temples, and they had all of these altars, and all of these animals that would go on the altars. And usually the way the priests would eat would, they would, well, you, if you think about what an altar is, it's really a giant barbecue pit. And you put these huge animals on the barbecue pit, and you cook the meat. And basically, after the meat was cooked, the priests would eat the meat. But there's so much meat, the priests couldn't eat it all. So what did they do? They sold it in the marketplace. And if you were an observant Jew, and you were shopping for meat in the marketplace, you would ask, did this come from the temple? And if the person would say yes, the Jew would need it. But this church in Corinth is made up of Gentiles. They've been eating and buying this meat the whole time. Now, one of the side, remember they had all these factions fighting. One side said, idols are nothing. No harm, no foul. Eat what you want. The other side of the church was saying, Well, demons are behind these idols. Would you eat meat that had been offered in sacrifice to a demon? Part of the difficulty we have in reading this book is that, unlike modern English, where you have nice things called quotation marks, ancient Greek didn't have any quotation marks. And so when you're reading the book of Corinthians and you're trying to figure it out, Paul, we know, is often quoting his rivals, but we don't know, therefore, if a particular point is being made by Paul or Paul is just quoting his rivals. Now, for us, how many of you, when you go into Bel Air, knock on the door and say, "Can I look back into the butcher room? I want to make sure there's no pictures or statues that are around where they're carving up the cow." We don't think about that at all. We're not thinking about, well, was he, what religion is the butcher? Part of me, because you see the guy coming out of Bel Air, he's putting me, "Part of me, sir, are you a Christian? I only want to eat meat from a Christian butcher." How many of you have ever asked the butcher at Bel Air about his religious convictions? None of you. I know there's a lot of you that go to that Bel Air very regularly because I see you there. Never once have you asked about the religious conviction of the butcher. And so this issue, we don't pay any attention to. Chapter 8, chapter 9, and chapter 10, Paul devotes to this issue as kind of an object lesson about this question, which is beneath the questions that people ask when they come into church. "Pastor, just give me the list of rules by which I know I qualify for the kinds of things God is giving away." Oh, well, really interrogate your butcher to find out what exactly he believes before he butchers the cow. I would dare bet you can find zero churches in America that have that on their list. It's three chapters in this important book of the New Testament. So Paul summarizes this section in this way. "I have the right to do anything." Now you'll notice here in the NIV there are quotation marks again around that. And the NIV also drops in "you say." If you go to the King James or the RSV, you won't find that in there because the NIV editors have studied this and said, "We're pretty sure this is what one of the factions in Corinth is asserting, and Paul is going to counter it." "I have the right to do anything, you say, but not everything is beneficial." Notice no quotation marks around that. "I have the right to do anything," quotation marks around it again. "But not everything is constructive," Paul says. "No one should seek their own good, but the good of others." Now, no quotations about this. We believe this is Paul's assertion. "Eat anything sold in the meat market without raising questions of conscience. For the earth is the Lord's and everything in it." There's quotation marks around that. But that's a quotation from the Old Testament. So you can see, even our own quotation marks, you got to watch them. "If an unbeliever invites you to a meal and you want to go, eat whatever is put before you without raising questions of conscience." This is basically what Paul is teaching the church. So somebody invites you to their house and they set meat before you. What do you do? A good Jew might say, well, first of all, a good Jew probably wouldn't be eating in that house unless they knew. So you go to this house, don't interrogate the host about the source of the meat. But if someone says to you, "This was offered in sacrifice to an idol," then do not eat it, both for the sake of the one who told you and for the sake of conscience. But I'm referring to the other person's conscience, not yours. For why is my freedom being judged by another's conscience? If I take part in the meal with thankfulness, why am I denounced because of something I thank God for? What's he saying? So you're sitting at this feast, and you're sitting down, and you're going to enjoy this meat. And again, they didn't eat meat that often. And someone next to you says, "The meat was sacrificed to idols." And you see that they've got a lot of stress about it. Paul says, don't stress them further. And you can see right in there, we talked about this last November, Paul's focus wasn't on what was on the plate. Paul's focus was on the relationship between your neighbor and what's in their heart. Because you don't want to cause them to stumble. And there's a lot to that, which I'm not going to go into. I did it last year, and you can always go look up the sermon again on the internet. But Paul's focus isn't on what's in the meat. His focus is on what's in the heart. So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all to the glory of God. Do not cause anyone to stumble, whether Jews or Greeks or in the church of God. Even if I try to please everyone and everyone, for I am not seeking my own good, but the good of many. So right there's the orientation. The orientation is the other, so that they may be saved. Follow my example as I follow the example of Christ. Now with this illustration, most of us will say, yeah, that makes sense. That makes good sense. Sort of read the room, figure out what's important, and act in love toward your neighbor. But there are other issues that are not so easy for us. This is a little cartoon, appeared a number of years ago, and there was a lot of tension or attention being paid to Islam and certain Islamic communities where women are covered from head to toe except for a little slit. And you'll bump into people like this someplace. So here you have two women, both looking at the other and having thoughts about their attire. The woman in the bikini thinks to herself, everything covered but her eyes. What a cruel, male-dominated culture. The woman in the burqa thinking, nothing covered but her eyes. What a cruel, male-dominated culture. And you see right there the tension that, well, on one hand, you can't say dress is unimportant. On the other hand, you can note that, well, it's not exactly clear. How much clothing should I wear? What parts of my body should be covered? There's a whole lot that goes into that. In fact, one of the members of our local meetup is Sikh. And over the last couple of years, he's adopted the turban on his head. Now, many people don't recognize that turbans are part of the Sikh religion, which is a little group up in northern India. A lot of people would say they're Arabs. Well, they're actually far from Arabs. And if you wonder about this turban, it's because many Sikhs don't believe that they should cut their hair. And so you can imagine a lot of Sikhs have a lot of hair in there. I could wear a turban and people wouldn't know that, you know, I don't have much hair up there anymore. But if you read this article, interestingly, out of Grand Rapids, this person says, well, Makar believes honoring God includes never shearing my head, never shearing any hair on his body. Doing this would mar the perfection of God's creation, he believes. So in other words, God gave him hair. Why cut away the gift? And, I guess I can understand that. It is a gift from God. Being bald is a pain. You got to try not to let that head get sunburned up there. I really liked my hair when I had it. But women, too, and you notice that some cultures, and especially in the ancient world, a woman would never let her hair hang in public. That's just, no one should see her hair but her husband and her immediate family. That would be hugely sexually inappropriate. We don't think anything of it. And if you really want an issue that we sort of wrestle with, well, what about breasts? Well, what about breasts? Well, many cultures in the world, for most of human history, thought nothing of breasts being exposed. When I preach in the Dominican Republic, we'd be in church, women would often be nursing their young, and, you know, just right there in the middle of church. Now, they had women sitting on one side and men on the other side, and you'll notice, if you look, all of the women have their heads covered. Well, why? Well, they should have their heads covered. where women always wore hats, right? What's going on? Often these things sort of are around women, yet here, this painting from the French Revolution, this is sort of the god of liberty, and her breasts are exposed in the picture. And that's not incidental to the picture or the image, as it wasn't in Artemis in Ephesus, and the whole fight about that temple. So actually, this is an enormous question throughout human history, and I would dare bet if women would come to church with exposed breasts, well, suddenly the conversation would no longer be theoretical or unemotional in church. Even though there are places in the world where, in the Dominican Republic, for example, when a woman would come into church, she would take a handkerchief, a ball cap, wouldn't matter, something's got to go on that head. And it's from the next section. I praise you for remembering me and everything and holding to the traditions just as I pass them on to you. And we wonder, wow, I wish this wasn't a letter. I'd really love to know the list, but it's not here. But I want you to realize that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. Wow, there's a lot in that section, because the question of which aspect of head are you talking about? Because the head of the Nile is in Lake Victoria. So what do you mean by head? The head of a pin? The head of a country? What do we mean by head? Every man who prays or prophesies with his head uncovered, with his head covered, dishonors his head. Now, in certain cultures, even in American cultures, to walk into this building with a hat on for a man should take his hat off when he goes in a building, right? Woman, when she comes in the building, should put a hat on. And we're thinking, wait a minute, what's going on with these hats? But every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. Wait a minute. Is that her physical head? Or is she dishonoring her man? But what if she's single? Is it her father? Or you would not believe how much ink has been spilled on this particular chapter trying to figure it out. One of the things that is interesting is it's very plain that women were prophesying in the Church of Corinth. Women were doing that vocally. They were not silent. And this gets into other passages in the book. For a woman does not cover her head, she might as well have her head shaved off. Where does that come from? But it is a disgrace for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved. After the Second World War, you can find pictures in many of the places where, for example, in the Netherlands, where they were liberated from the Nazi occupation, women who slept with German soldiers, they dragged them into the streets, they exposed their breasts, and they shaved their head. And you'd say, why did they do those two things to those women? What did that mean? Everybody understood what it meant, but where's the book that says what it means? For it is a great disgrace for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved. So now she's sort of like the Sikh men? Then she should cover her head. So wait a minute. So can you have long hair and no head covering? Or if you cut your hair, you have to wear a head covering? In other words, applying this, we don't really know what to do. A man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God. But a woman is the glory of man. For man did not come from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. It is for this reason that a woman ought to have authority over her head, her physical head, or her man, because of the angels. And we have no idea how that fits into this. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor is man independent of woman. For as woman came from man, so also man is born of woman. But everything comes from God. Judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? Now, I want all you women to notice this, because when you maybe go home this evening and you have your devotions, better get the hat on. Do you women cover your head when you have devotions? Does not the very nature of things teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a disgrace to him? Well, now we sound like we're fighting about long hair in the 60s. But that if a woman has long hair, it is her glory. For long hair is given to her as a covering. If anyone wants to be contentious about this, we have no other practice, nor do the churches of God. Now, quite clearly, Paul and the church at Corinth knew what they were talking about in this section. Almost as clearly, the history of Christian interpretation does not. And I am not going to walk through this passage with all of the different permutations that have been worked through in the history of Christian interpretation. These are two very interesting books that take two rather different takes on it. The one book, in fact, the entire book is dedicated to this passage to try to figure this out and the history of interpretation. And what's amazing is that I dare bet, no matter what I tell you this morning, it's probably not going to impact whether you women are going to have hats on. Now watch, Forrest is coming in. See if he keeps his hat on. Forrest, why'd you take off your hat? See, he took off his hat because he comes in the doors. And as he would say, because my mama raised me right. You come in the church, you take off your hat. Marshall, why'd you wear a hat this morning?
I wear hats all the time.
She wears hats all the time. And my point is, even if I walk through this passage, what's governing your hats on, hats off, long hair, short hair, all of these things, you're probably not going to change because stuff has been baked into you for a very long time, even though this passage has been swirling around the Christian church for 2,000 years. The text continues to impact behavior, and there were sometimes rather feverish debates in the Dominican Republic about should women wear head coverings in church. And you go out to the churches way out in the boonies, and women would always be in, but in the big cities where things were fashionable, women would come into church and they wouldn't have hats on their head. And the fight goes on. Meat sacrificed to idols disappears when the temples go away. Head coverings, hair length, standards of appropriate or inappropriate dress continue throughout the ages. Do women head covering churches outperform churches with women without head coverings or particular hair length? What's your measure of success? Now, people raise questions and they want to know answers. And some of these things we say they are indifferent. You can come to Living Stones and, you know, if Forrest had kept his hat on this morning, I wouldn't have a problem. I knew he'd take it off when he walked through the door, though. And when Marshall wears a hat to church, Marshall, like she says, she always wears a hat. When she comes in the middle of the week, she's wearing a hat. She wears a hat a lot. I've never seen Nina with a hat on in church. Here we are. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? We want to engage for hope of glory, but practices need to sort of make sense, even if we can't explain them. One of the things that you might have noticed is, why is the pastor always on the last few slides of his sermon have misery, deliverance, gratitude? And some of you will say, oh, wait a minute, that's like the second question and answer of the Heidelberg Catechism. Yeah. Those are sort of the three main sections of the Heidelberg Catechism. Yeah. And I always use this, and I use it quite a bit on the internet, actually, because people come and they say, okay, pastor, I want to know the right answer. Women, hats in church, yes or no? And I say, I don't think it probably means a lot in general, but it might mean a lot in a particular place. We got feedback this morning, Raj? In the Dominican Republic, if a woman would say to me, missionary, should I wear a hat to church? I'd probably say, yeah. Why? Because that's sort of the custom of the place. And if you want to fit in, if you don't want to fight about hats, which you probably shouldn't fight about, just put something on your head. Well, I don't want to. Okay, then don't. But then you're probably going to have to deal with a whole bunch of little fighting. That's kind of what we do with dress. I mean, if I decided I was going to preach in a loud Hawaiian shirt and some shorts, you would be like, well, you know, yeah. But I can imagine some really elaborate dress that would offend you. And the elders would take me aside and they'd say, Pastor, it's about what you wore last week. And we all kind of have a sense of this. But the deeper things that are working, I think, are kind of articulated as misery, deliverance, gratitude. The quest for behavioral ticket is lost amidst all of this diversity. If you're attending, this is what happened when work teams or people from North America would visit a church in the Dominican Republic. You want to know what the real battle was? Could women wear pants? That was the real fight in the Dominican Republic. And so when the visitors from North America would come and they were going to come to a church, I would say, ladies, just for the sake of the people there, wear a skirt and have something you can put on your head. Does it mean I think it's a horrible thing if you don't? No. It's just, it's a fine thing to do to signal to the people, these are their cultural values, you respect them, you want to fit in. It's just that small. It doesn't mean, however, that patterns don't arise. And when Forrest takes off his hat when he comes into the church, he is signaling respect. Even if it's tied to this passage that we barely know our way through. Synod starts this week in the Christian Reformed Church. They're going to have a whale of a fight that very well may divide the denomination over sexual ethics. Most Christians believe that's a rather substantive issue. Our beliefs, however, aren't subject to our will. We have all sorts of ideas about all kinds of things. And when we're asked to testify how we got them, well, maybe my mama raised me this way, or I just don't think that's right. We're a jumble of these things. And behaviors and practices are complex. Often in every church, there's someone who believes and behaves in a rather oddball way in one thing or another, and the whole church just says, not a big deal. I'm a synodical deputy, and I visit Korean classes, and by and large, the Korean churches in America are very against women ministers. I'm in a classes meeting one day, and a woman comes in and sits down. And I've often got it translated, because the point of the classes is that they conduct business in Korean. And I look at the translator, who's a young guy, and I said, what's up with her? Well, she's a woman pastor. I said, what? He just said, I don't know. They're all against women pastors, but here she is. People are funny that way. And we're not going to sort this out and put it all into nice little boxes. Even what ChatGPT notes is that the gospel says that someone has come to deliver us from what we're stuck in. And even if we're not in all agreement about the details of our stuckness, this is hope for our salvation. And even as I press people on what they mean by salvation, they get a little fuzzy, they kind of have a sense of it, a good enough sense. And you see this right at the beginning of the book. Paul in this book is about to excoriate the Corinthian church that's full of themselves. And Paul begins the book with a sentence like this. I always thank God for you because of his grace given to you in Christ Jesus. For in him you have been enriched in every way, with all kinds of speech and with all knowledge. God thus confirming our testimony about Christ among you. Therefore you do not lack any spiritual gift as you eagerly wait for our Lord Jesus Christ to be revealed. Why don't you start the church, the letter saying, you're the worst church I got to deal with. No, he doesn't say that. It says, although you're the worst church I got to deal with, you are a church, and Jesus loves you, and he is working in your midst to perfect you. Even if I look at you compared to churches you have no toleration for, you're the worst of the bunch. Paul's amazing that way. He goes back and forth. Although you're a mess, God isn't finished with you, and he's going to continue his work. The key why I talk about misery, deliverance, gratitude is this deliverance isn't earned by your performance. When you come to judgment day and Forrest stands before his Lord, is the Lord going to say, Forrest, it's about those hats. I don't think the hats are going to come up. I don't think the hats are going to be anywhere in the conversation. Because we don't earn our salvation. It's a gift from God. It's given by grace. And even ChatGPT knows that. Our obedience doesn't purchase God's grace. Obedience, reshaping, practices, are how we respond to the gifts given to us. That's why all of this is not under misery, although we fight about it. It's not under deliverance, because we don't earn it. This is the gift we give back to God. Obedience is still consequential. I'm not saying all of this doesn't matter at all, but this doesn't earn our place at the table. Deliverance is God's gift to us. Gratitude is the obedience we give back to God. And this is found all the way down to the Lord's Supper. The practices of gratitude create Christ-likeness in us. The discipline of gratitude and the discipline of obedience begin to reform us and reshape us. Because, like I said, we believe all kinds of things and we don't know why we believe them. One way to change your belief is to actually begin to change your behavior. Because just like behaviors follow beliefs, beliefs also follow behaviors. So we participate in a feast that we didn't earn. We receive his grace, and if in time we grow in obedience, we begin to learn to give it to others. And this is within this meal that we celebrate regularly. Jesus didn't take the bread and say, now I've made a careful inventory of the moral performance of my disciples, and so I'd like all of you who have done particularly well in the last week to sit over here and we'll have the meal together, and you all over there who've been really not behaving up to standard, you get to sit and watch. Now you laugh, but this is sort of the way it went in the Dominican Republic with the people. Because up in the front of the church, the official members would kneel down, and first we'd have our foot washing ceremony. There might be 6 or 7 people in the front who were getting communion, and there were 20, 30 in the seats that were watching. And someone coming from North America might say, now, Pastor, why didn't you fix them of that? It's a little more complicated than that. It's a little more complicated. And Paul's letter to the church of Corinth probably didn't fix them right away. They didn't read the letter and say, oh, Paul says this. No, you know what they said? Oh, Paul said this. We don't like him anymore. Throw it away. That's usually what happens. And so God comes up with us in a much more subtle way. And so he has his disciples around them. And they're practicing the Jewish Passover meal, and he takes bread, and he says something very alarming. On the night he was betrayed, and of course, if someone's on the naughty list, it should be Judas. On the night he was betrayed, he took bread, and he broke it. And he said, this is for the good people, and this is for the bad people. No, he didn't say that. He said, this is my body, broken for you. As often as you eat this, remember me. I don't know if she needs a door open for us or if they have a problem. Of course, she's going to go check it out. Of course, she needs a key right now. Yeah, timing was amazing.